Live from the Pathway Studios in Johnston proper, you are Live from the Path.
On this first Monday of the new year, hanging out with Live from the Path.
We're gonna get 52 shows in this year.
Shoot, you know what? Pete asked me to get up to 52, and I was going to stub a few and put some cryptic things in on show 50. Like, because I think we only got to, what, 42 or 43?
It was a lackluster effort on our part.
Here's the deal. We had never missed shows. Like, we had been, like, there's all kinds of Monday holidays and stuff. We just didn't miss. But the last year has been funky. So we'll try to be on our game there, boys. We're sort of tightening up on the job, homie. We'll see if we can get that thing pulled together. Anyway, welcome to Live from the Path. We're about honest faith, fierce grace, and donkeys, because we love Jesus. We're doing the best we can to follow him, to take people with us. That involves all kinds of things in life, various circumstances as husbands, wives, parents.
Kids.
Kids.
Farm animals.
And donkeys. Yeah. Yeah. So that's the deal. Thanks for hanging out with us. If you ever want to get a hold of us, just shoot us an email, info@livefromthepath.org, and we'd love to hear what you think, and hopefully can refrain what we think, because we don't know what's going on. So here's what I think we got going on the show tonight. I ran across an article in the New York Times, and it was it was like a column, and it was a guy basically, am I a Christian? He was asking. It was an interview with Tim Keller, who's a pastor in New York, maybe New York. Anyway, somewhere on the East Coast.
who's the guy in Minnesota?
Are you thinking, well, John Piper?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, but I mean, sorry. Yep.
He retired, yep. Mike.
Cancel.
He's out of the game.
I'm not hip to what's going on in the Christian world.
Anyway, Tim Keller's a good dude, and if you want to listen to, he's a good guy to podcast. But this guy from the New York Times was basically asking him a question. So what I want to do is I want to give you his answer, and we'll see what we think about his answer to this question. Basically, am I a Christian? And then there was a rebuttal that said his response was completely inappropriate. And
was a rebuttal by a Christian?
Yeah,
no doubt. Okay,
yeah, and then we'll see if we can figure out, is there what can we agree with some of these with these answers, and you know, how would we answer kind of a similar thing? And so we're going to do that. We also have some advice on Dear Life from the Path. No reason not to ring in the new year with some advice. People need help, and we're here to give it. And so we're going to do that. Also, it was interesting. I'm just going to throw this out here because it's been on my mind. I was reading an interview with a guy named Jason Fried. He was he runs a company called Basecamp. It's an online collaboration tool. He started off as a programmer and then ended up kind of creating a company that creates business tools. And his basic premise is that, like, we create tools that we would use and then we share them with other people. And I thought, well, that sounds great, because if we wouldn't use it, we certainly don't want to sell it to other people. And anyway, I really like this guy. The company used to be called 37 Signals, is now just called Basecamp. But you can find some books out there that he's written before about how to do certain things. He was a guy that came to my attention as I was reading some of his stuff, and things that really started to click for me. Like, he was talking about meetings in corporations and even smaller businesses and stuff, and said, like, do you realize how much time and talent and money you're putting into meetings? Because if you have one meeting for an hour that has 20 people in it, that's 20 business hours you committed to whatever went on there. And, like, when was the last time you looked at a meeting and said, you know what, we got 20 hours worth of work done in there. It was worth it to having everybody on. And so his takeaway was like, A, the best thing you do is cancel the meeting. Just stop meeting the damn thing. Like, you don't need to be in there all the time. Right. At the very least, get it down to whoever needs to be in there, because recognize you're paying guys to do a certain amount of work, and they can't get their work done because they're sitting in meetings with you all the time. And so, anyways, it's just a cool way to think about business. But one of the things he said was you need to protect your attention. And he gave the example, said he used to have, like, multiple computers and multiple monitors. And over the last 2 or 3 years, like, he's got himself whittled down to a single, like, 13-inch MacBook. And he runs his programs at full screen all the time. Because, you know, if you give the things the ability to pull your attention away...
They will.
Yeah, they will, right? So, like, if you have, and this, I noticed this with my phone. My phone dings, I go check it out. And, like, almost freaking always, it's like some... online retailer that I signed up for once, and they're like, hey, we're having a sale coming up in 48 hours. I'm like, I don't give a damn. Like, I wasn't going to buy one of those. I wasn't thinking about buying one of those. And so, but it took my attention away from something that I purposely put my attention on. And so I'm not protecting my attention. I'm saying, hey, whatever can ding or flash or speak loudest, I'm willing to be pulled away from. And I thought, like, that's no way to live life. Like, that's how I don't read when I want to. That's how I don't focus on things that I want to. It impacts things like my prayer life or my Bible reading or my attention on my kids or my wife. Like, I'm willing to have my attention. I gave something permission to pull my attention away from something that I intentionally looked at to something that I don't care about.
Yeah, see, and I feel like some of that starts to get ingrained in a guy. You know what I'm saying? I feel like I only have like 10 seconds. And then my attention has to renew, right? Like, I was watching a movie with my kids. We were watching one of the Harry Potters or whatever, you know. And after about 10 minutes, I got a little itchy. You know, like I should be doing something else too. Or something new should happen. Or, you know, maybe I should make sure nothing happened onto Facebook. Or,
right.
You know what I'm saying? Or maybe the dog need let out or something. Like, every 10 minutes or so, I'm like, I feel like I used to be able to watch a movie and watch a movie. You know, and this is this is not even like a redeeming pastime, you know, something that is going, that is building, like spending quality time with your kids playing a board game or something. Like, I'm just talking about relaxing and watching a movie. I can't even do that in 10-minute spurts without feeling like I should have been doing something else, like something else needs to be taking my attention, or I can handle two things at once.
Yeah,
you know, like I should be doing, you know, concentrating on something else and watching this movie, because then I can get both done at the same time. And like to the detriment of both things, like I enjoyed the movie less because I couldn't sit there and watch it without feeling like my attention needed to pull elsewhere.
Yeah.
And if something did pull elsewhere, I wasn't really paying a whole lot of attention to it because I was trying to watch the movie. And I'm like, and I thought, man, is this what some about having your whole life in a 3x5 instrument that's attached to you everywhere you go? Is this the consequence that we're now paying? You know what I'm saying?
Right, right. It's right, like that. That's not of the technology itself is not of the devil. But I made it a devil, right? Like I gave it control over my life, as opposed to being a tool that helps me. Sometimes it is a box that controls me. And you're right. Like we were talking about this just a little bit before the show. Is that where did this sense of that we have to be up to date on something? Right, like, where does this sense come from that, hey, I have to know what happened in somebody's life, like, within the next 5 minutes? You know how many people call me and tell me, hey, this just happened? Like, I don't – if it's important, they call or text. If not, like, I kind of find out whenever I need to. And, like, I feel I've got this burden of being in the know that is not advantageous or beneficial to the relationship of which I'm trying to be in the know about. And, in fact, sometimes it gives me information – before it's passed through the right filters of the person that wants to share it with me, before they digested it, because they happen to dump it out on social media or something. And you're right, like ditching this thought that says I have to be kept up to date, even with news. You know, I know people who don't do, they just don't watch the news. They barely take any of it in. And like, I'm not sure it's all that detrimental to their lives. Like, right. I've not made, they're a functioning member of society. Their kids are cool. You know what I'm saying? Like, I look at 15 different news websites a day, and I'll refresh them, and I'll come back, and I'll check Facebook, and I think to myself, like, yeah, I might know a cultural quip to share every once in a while, or be able to tell my wife that someone from the Dukes of Hazzard died this week before she'd find out about it. But like, to what advantage in life did I create here, allowing my attention to be dragged from the things that I want to focus on? Like, almost, it's not against my will, but I gave permission when I shouldn't have.
Well, and if you think about it, like, I mean, this is what I hear constantly, is like, we live in a fast-paced society, a fast-paced world, people are constantly stressed or whatever, and like, the truth of the matter is, like, we're going through all kinds of ways, like, my fancy smartwatch tells me to, like, well, twice a day it'll ding at me and say, breathe, and it'll take, like, this little concentric circle, and then it'll make it bigger, 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 bigger as you breathe, and then let it all out. And like, so now my technology is trying to help me to calm down and have a less stressful time because it's helping me breathe better. And I thought, you know, here's the thing. You're part of the problem. Watch, you know, like you come after me with stupid things that I didn't have any intention of allowing to fill my head. And the truth is like I do that all day. The reason I'm stressed out is because I got my foot, my toenail, one of my elbows and half my hair in problems that are none of my business.
Right.
Like all these things are none of my, like, am I sorry that like Carrie Fisher passed away? Yeah, that's sad, but I don't know her. You know what I'm saying? Right. Like, I'm sorry she died, and I'm sure that's probably really hard for her family, and you know, I feel empathy there. But, like, the truth of the matter is, I've spent more time reading articles on Carrie Fisher in the last week that, like, were of no benefit to anybody. They weren't a benefit to her. They weren't a benefit to me. They didn't benefit my family, my wife, my job, nothing. Right? Right. They did nothing but take time that I was given and dump it towards things that I can do nothing about.
Yeah.
And so, like, as a whole, I don't know. Like, people look to technology to solve a lot of their problems. And don't get me wrong. Like, I couldn't live without my phone either. I love the podcast. I podcast everything.
Yeah.
You know, but, like, in the long run, it's not enriched my life.
No.
You know what I'm saying? And it's actually created anxiety where anxiety doesn't belong. If my wife does not answer my text message within a couple minutes, I'm like, something's up. Something's wrong. Or she mad at me. Maybe she don't want to answer my text right now because she's angry at me. I'm like, you know, I can remember when I was like five, you know, when you call somebody, they didn't pick up, they get back to you maybe tomorrow.
Yeah.
And you weren't sitting at home fretting it out. You know, you're just like, eh, they're not by the phone, no big deal. Or they went out to the grocery store and it took them 20 extra minutes. You didn't freak out.
Right.
You know, you just sat and waited for them to get back. But now, if they're gone 5 minutes longer than you think, you're hitting them up with a text, a couple calls, hit them on a Facebook Messenger. What's going on? What's happened? Did the car break down? Did you get locked out? Blah, blah, blah. I mean, it's created a whole culture inside your head that's hard to deal with.
Right, right. And I think to a certain extent we know that. It's just difficult to change some of this normative behavior. But, like, I think we need the right perspective is to recognize something that is supposed to be helpful is dominating you, and that's not cool.
That's right. You're being owned by something.
Yeah. And you've agreed to it, and that's a problem. Like, actually, it's one of the things where, like, and I hate that this happens, but, like, we'll have this discussion with my kids, is that, like, I'm okay with, hey, we'd like to, I don't know, we want to play, we just got a Wii this year. We bought, here's the deal, I was excited about this because I told my wife, this year we bought a Wii for them for Christmas, like the original Wii.
Yeah.
And a 2008 Dodge Caravan like 2 or 3 months ago. And I said, look, I'm just as excited as if I'd bought both of these things brand spanking new. I just got them for like a third of the price. I think we paid $35 for that Wii.
That's pretty great.
Yeah. And so I thought, like, all I got to do is be able to be on the back end of a very long curve, and I get the same amount of enjoyment. I just got to wait a little bit. But anyway, but, like, you know, they might ask, hey, can we play this? And if I say no and they, you know, and they break down about it or they want to have, like, something to eat, like, I don't know, candy or something, and they – if something owns them, I hate it. Like, there's no way I'm ever bending on something that owns you because I will not feed into this thought that, like, you are owned by a piece of chocolate. Or you are owned by the video game system. And, like, let's just say that I'm a little bit more amenable to, hey, you know, you trying to bargain with me
right.
about, like, hey, this is why this is a good time for me to have chocolate and play to eat. But, like, to the extent that I find out that something owns you, like, I'll cut that thing off. Because just this thought that says you are being dominated by this to the extent that's causing you to break down crying or to overreact, you do not have control of your emotions because of your desire for this thing, then I say, no, we got to cut that out because it's owning you. And then you're right. You think to yourself, like, how do I react to my phone, which is intended to serve me, that I'm paying to serve me, and am I being owned by the ding of some guy who decided to email blast his 10,000 customers?
Right. There's a new RV for sale in the upper parts of Iowa for like $7,500. Ding. I mean, I'm not in the market for an RV.
Yeah.
You know?
And I think I might be, you know, like every once in a while. And here's the thing. I don't mind free checking, but if I got some time and I want to go to something and look. But, like, although pushing information to you saves you a lot of effort, it also causes you to start looking at things that maybe you don't need to look at. So maybe the thing is you just got to take more control over that. I spent most of the day yesterday trying to figure out all the sinews attached to an old email account so I could just delete the thing. I said, I don't want emails from this thing anymore. I don't use it. But, like, I figured out that I had it attached to, I don't know, my tax return from last year because I switched this year. And so I'm like, shoot, it's a good thing I checked. But, like, that stuff's got to go. I got too many emails. I was looking around, and I had, like, three computers up, like my wife's laptop, my laptop, and I have a work laptop. And I think, I this is too much. I need something needs to go. I need to figure out how to get rid of this stuff. Anyway, broad reason I'm talking about it is, like, I've found it very valuable, even with the first 2 days of this year, is to protect your attention. I mean, I wrote it on a piece of paper, and I took a picture of it with my phone, and then I put it as my phone background. So that whenever I open my phone, it says, like, you know, what has your attention? So that I try to keep me from digging around at stuff and wasting time and not reading books and not looking at Facebook when I want to be reading books. You know, not cleaning out email when I should just delete the email account. Stuff like that. So anyway, if I have a broad recommendation to take my problems and put them on you, it's to guard your own attention and don't be dominated by things that are supposed to serve you.
You know, it's funny. I like the words of Driscoll come to my head. He was talking about something, I don't know, 4 or 5 years ago, and he was talking about people like, hey, I'm having this problem, and he says, counseling's easier than you think. You say, hey, what do you want to do? And they'll say what they want to do, and then you say, well, what do you think God wants you to do? And then they'll say something different, and you say, go with what God wants you to do. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just that easy. And, like, some of the things that, like, with when we get wrapped up with technology, especially phones, you know, like, people will lament the fact that they've spent all this time on their phone or spent all this time on Facebook, or maybe they don't even notice it and think they're doing just fine, you know, just to realize that they felt like they were busy all day and they didn't do anything.
Yeah.
You know, well, the truth is like, did you do what you wanted to do? What was your plan for today that you did not get done because you were owned by, you know, a small electronic device that was bossing you around all day?
Yeah.
The Lord has given us dominion over the animals, and we're getting beat up by our own creation.
Yeah, exactly.
That's terrible.
Yeah, it's time to own that. This is your own that. And then now that you've taken control of your life, now figure out what you want to do with it and do that.
But definitely stick with podcasting, especially the Life from the Path podcast.
Yes.
There's no reason to bail on that. That's edifying.
No, that's true. Hey, and if you could do us a favor and give us and go rate us on iTunes, that's real helpful. It's beneficial for us, for more people to listen to the show if it gets some ratings and that kind of thing. So if you could, if you could rate the show, that'd be very helpful for us. All right. So here's what I was looking at this week. There was a New York Times article, and it was he was basically asking questions of Tim Keller. The author's name is Nicholas Kristof, and we can't read all of these. But let me go through a couple of them, okay? So he says, Tim, I deeply admire Jesus and his message, but I'm also skeptical of themes that have been integral to Christianity, the virgin birth, the resurrection, the miracles, and so on. Since this is the Christmas season, let's start with the virgin birth. Is that an essential belief, or can I mix and match? Keller's response was, if something is truly integral to a body of thought, you can't remove it without destabilizing the whole thing. A religion can't be whatever we desire it to be. If I'm a member of the board of Greenpeace and I come out and say climate change is a hoax, they will ask me to resign. I could call them narrow-minded, but they would rightly say that there have to be some boundaries for dissent, or you couldn't have a cohesive, integrated organization. And they'd be right. It's the same way with any religious faith. The response was, but the earliest accounts of Jesus' life, like the Gospel of Mark and Paul's letter to the Galatians, don't even mention the virgin birth. And the reference in Luke to the virgin birth was written in a different kind of Greek and was probably added later. So isn't there room for skepticism? I don't know if I agree with the premise of that question, but here's Keller's response. If it were simply a legend that could be dismissed, it would damage the fabric of the Christian message. Luke Ferry, looking at the Gospel of John's account of Jesus' birth into the world, said this taught that the power behind the whole universe was not just an impersonal cosmic principle, but a real person who could be known and loved. That scandalized Greek and Roman philosophers, but was revolutionary in the history of human thought. It led to a new emphasis on the importance of the individual person and on love as a supreme virtue, because Jesus was not just a great human being, but the pre-existing Creator God miraculously come to earth as a human being. Further question, and the resurrection, must it really be taken literally? He says, Jesus' teaching was not the main point of his mission. He came to save people through his death for sin and his resurrection. So his important ethical teaching only makes sense when you don't separate it from these historic doctrines. If the resurrection is a genuine reality, it explains why Jesus can say that the poor and meek will inherit the earth. St. Paul said, without a real resurrection, Christianity is useless. All right, well, he has one more that we'll bother reading. He says, but let me push back. As you know better than I, the scriptures themselves indicate that the resurrection wasn't so clear-cut. Mary Magdalene didn't initially recognize the risen Jesus, nor did some disciples. And the Gospels are fuzzy about Jesus' literal presence, especially Mark, the first Gospel to be written. So if you take these passages as meaning that Jesus literally rose from the dead, why the fuzziness? Again, the basis for that question is off, but here's his response. I wouldn't characterize the New Testament descriptions of the risen Jesus as fuzzy. They're very concrete in their details. Yes, Mary doesn't recognize Jesus at first, but then she does. The two disciples on the road to Emmaus also don't recognize Jesus at first. Their experience was analogous to meeting someone you last saw as a child 20 years ago. Many historians have argued that this has the ring of eyewitness authenticity. If you were making up a story about the resurrection, would you have imagined that Jesus was altered enough to not be identified immediately, but not so much that he couldn't be recognized after a few moments? As for Mark's gospel, yes, it ends very abruptly without getting to the resurrection, but most scholars believe that the last part of the book or scroll was lost to us. Skeptics should consider another surprising aspect of these accounts. Mary Magdalene is named as the first eyewitness of the risen Christ, and other women are mentioned as the earliest eyewitnesses in the other Gospels too. This was a time in which the testimony of women was not admissible evidence in courts because of their low social status. The early pagan critics of Christianity latched onto this and dismissed the resurrection as the word of hysterical females. If the gospel writers were inventing these narratives, they would never have put women in them, so they didn't invent them. The Christian church is pretty much inexplicable if we don't believe in a physical resurrection. N.T. Wright has argued in The Resurrection of the Son of God that it is difficult to come up with any historically plausible alternate explanation for the birth of the Christian movement. It is hard to account for the thousands of Jews virtually overnight worshiping a human being as divine when everything about their religion and culture conditioned them to believe that was not only impossible, but deeply heretical. The best explanation for the change was that many hundreds of them had actually seen Jesus with their own eyes. Sorry, one more. So where does that leave people like me, is the question. Am I a Christian, a Jesus follower, a secular Christian? Can I be a Christian while doubting the resurrection? I wouldn't, and here's the answer, I wouldn't draw any conclusion about an individual without talking to him or her at length, but in general, if you don't accept the resurrection or other foundational beliefs as defined by the Apostles' Creed, I'd say you are on the outside of the boundary. So, I don't know, Mike, initial impressions on his answers?
I mean, overall, I mean, yeah, I mean, I agree with most of what he's saying. I mean, the part of me that doesn't know this man wants to hold a lot of grace in this conversation and say, well, you know, it's having doubt on some of the things that are in the Bible is not a something that's going to make God let go of you. You know what I'm saying? It doesn't quite work that way. If you're open to the premise that Jesus is God and was born of a virgin and died for your sins, then and you're just not quite there yet, head knowledge wise, I think that's okay.
Yeah,
you know, I get it. You know, yeah, that's a bit hard to swallow. If you're saying I could never buy into that. Because it's not physically possible, you're underestimating what your definition of God is pretty small. You know what I'm saying? Like, that's the freedom part of the scriptures for me is the things that I go, it's not physically possible, or that doesn't make any logical sense to me. And the thing is like God's ways aren't our ways. Like, if he did everything like I did, he would not be an impressive God. He would be rather lame.
Yeah.
And so, like, well, I think there's different ways to put those arguments. The truth of the matter is, if you do not believe that Jesus was the Son of God, and you do not believe that he came to die for sins that you could not otherwise recompense yourself to God the Father, then I you know, you're following a philosophical and moral teaching, which, you know, does not necessarily mean that you're following Jesus. You're just following a guy that you liked his actions.
Yeah, and one of the questions, and we'll get to this other response here because maybe this will help inform or direct the conversation. But, like, one of the questions I would have is, like, what do you care? Right? Like, if Christianity as a whole says, look, we believe a dude, God became a man and was birthed through a virgin and died on a cross and came back to life and had, in the interim, had taught a bunch of people and fed a bunch of people and, you know, it had a bunch of miracles and stuff. And you're like, you know, I just don't believe that part. Like, what do you care to be a Christian? You know what I'm saying? Like, if that's what Christianity is, why is it a deficit to you to not be that? Because, frankly, by your definition, there are a bunch of fools, you know, who believe weird things about a guy. You know, if you want to start your own deal and say, look, we'll take some of the stuff that Jesus says, we'll dismiss some of the ways that he claims to be Son of God and blah, blah, blah. But, like, there's a desire to be part of a group of people where you don't agree with some of the things that they otherwise would believe. And I get that there's a lot of ground there because there's denominational differences that you'd have to ask that same question. I understand. But what I'm asking is I wonder where does the compulsion say for me to say, I want to say I'm a Christian, but I want to do it under the premise of also rejecting some of these main tenets of Christianity.
So that's actually an issue that I think a majority of churches struggle with as well, right? Like, they want to engross you in the community of Christianity and then taper the tenets of what it is to follow Christ to some extent. Like, I'm not saying they do that on purpose. You know, it's not a devious misconception, right? But, like,
it's an introduction into a culture and a group of people, but not necessarily, like, under the guise of consistent ideas, but not necessarily like a committed following relationship with Jesus Christ.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? It's like you know, it wouldn't be any surprise to you if I told you that 80% of the people that sit in your church service really like this church. You know what I'm saying? They love the community. They love it. Like, I ask them. It's interesting. Ask people what they like most about their church, and very few people will say because the gospel is preached here.
Yeah, Jesus is here.
That's right. What they will say is we feel loved, we feel supported. People are always very nice to us, and like none of these are bad things. These are all great things, you know. But like, if the basically what they said is like, this is why we like being in this community, And, like, I don't have to accept all parts of Christianity because they're going to let me in this community anyway. And then I can enjoy the love and the kindness and the altruistic behavior of most people that are genuinely following Christ as a byproduct. And I can just be in this community. And you know, sometimes it's hard not to focus when you're growing your church on growing the church, the community yeah. itself, and not actual Christ followers. And then you start to, you know, you backpedal a little bit. Then you get a couple years into it or 5-10 years into it, and you're like, man, we have a great community here, but it feels like none of these Jesus principles are actually sticking. You know what I'm saying? Like, yeah. they're just kind of falling off a wet wall. And like, what have I done? And some of that you've done inherently. And I know this because I've been guilty of it, right? Like my first instinction for the first 10 years that I knew Jesus was to just invite people to church.
Yeah.
Right? Like I got to get them in the door. And I'm not saying that that's a bad thing. But the truth of the matter is I probably should just be introducing them to Jesus because I know them and love them. And like if that conversation is going to happen, that could just easily happen through me because I want you to know Jesus. And then I want you to come meet other people that are following Jesus that you can use to help strengthen and that you can feel supported and loved and all those things that God talks about being his church body. You know, but like yeah. he's struggling with the exact same question. If you put it in very simple terms, you know, almost all churches are struggling with these exact same questions. Just yeah. not these specifically, you know?
Yeah, yeah, no, I agree. So this is Peter, this is a response for a guy named Peter Enns. And I'm going to cut halfway. You should read that whole interview, by the way. Like, there were some other questions.
Who's Peter Enns? Is he a doctorate of some kind? Or just a schmo?
Yeah, I don't know.
Hold on. Did he say Peter Enns, schmo?
He runs a...
He better not run something online.
Well, I mean, he's got a website.
Oh, come on.
PeteEnns.com.
Yeah, okay.
He says he speaks...
I'm sure this is the man that says, I need to rebut this, definitely.
He does speaking.
Now continue on.
All right, so anyway, read the rest of that. He's going to ask some more questions about, like, is it okay to doubt? And he provides, he's like, yes, we should not encourage people to stifle all doubts. Doubts force us to think things out and reexamine our reasons, and that can, in the end, lead to a stronger faith. So, like, Tim Keller, I actually thought he handled the questions with grace. So,
yeah.
So anyway, Pete Enns responds though, and I'm going to start about halfway in to his rebuttal. He says, "What is triggering this post is Nicholas Kristof's recent interview of Tim Keller in the New York Times. Am I a Christian, Pastor Timothy Keller?" Kristof is asking questions of Keller about the challenges to being a Christian in the 21st century. You can read the brief interview for yourselves and draw your own conclusions. But I would have answered the questions quite differently from Keller, ironically, perhaps for pastoral reasons. I grant the constraints and artificiality of an interview. Kristof notes that the conversation has been edited for space and clarity. Even so, if I were genuinely struggling and skeptical about my standing in the Christian tradition, Keller's answers would have sounded more dismissive than pastoral, more in quick fix-it mode with ready answers than truly listening to the legitimacy of these recurring concerns. Despite Keller's protests, the virgin birth and resurrection of Jesus invite genuine intellectual skepticism, not simply because of the nature of these events, but precisely because of the Bible's varied and even confusing reports of them. Am I just too close to these accounts that this isn't a problem? Like, I'm just not noticing these problems.
No.
The resurrection accounts differ considerably from one another, makes sense, and cannot be merged. They were not meant to be. The virgin birth is known only to Luke and Matthew. Mark and John don't mention it. Mark and John also don't mention, you know, a vast bunch of other history that's going on.
Yeah, that doesn't mean that they're up for debate. It just means those guys are like, meh.
Yeah, and it's the same reason, like, you know, people would be saying, hey, why aren't there dinosaurs in saturating the Old Testament narrative? Well, it's not a book about dinosaurs.
I mean, I don't write down in my journal, and a dog walked by. You know what I'm saying? Like, it's just a given that they're dogs.
Yeah. The virgin birth is known only to Luke and Matthew. Mark and John don't mention it, and Paul, though given ample opportunity, never even alludes to it. Again, I'm not, like, the premise of Paul's arguments are already established who Jesus is. Simply reading the Bible raises the concerns, and intellectually speaking, they are not easily solved. All believers need to decide how to handle these things, and my point here is not to address that process. I only want to say that a truly pastoral response should begin, yes, I understand and respect the honest searching that has brought you to this point, and I acknowledge the Bible's ambiguities, rather than, to cite the article, if you don't accept the resurrection or other foundational beliefs as defined by the Apostles' Creed, I'd say you're on the outside of the boundary. Maybe it's just me. But if given a few lines, that's not what I want to say to someone raising these perennial questions. I want people to hear empathy and respect before getting into drawing lines. I know many will disagree with me that I'm putting the cart before the horse, but I disagree. I want people to know that they are valued as people first and that the Christian faith, Not to mention the long-honored and diverse history of Judaism has known that even, perhaps especially, the central pillars of faith wobble, and that the community of faith is precisely where these things can and should be worked through. Agree so far. Likewise, the challenge of science and modernity is a perennial one for many people of faith that I know of. To say, as Keller does, I don't see why faith should be seen as inconsistent with science, is to not take seriously a major, if not the major, source of cognitive dissonance for people today working through their faith. For example, on evolution, cultural anthropology, neuroscience, etc. This post is not against Keller, but against what he represents here in this article, the inadequacy, even incapability, of mainstream evangelicism to address pressing questions of faith of our day, forgiving answers that you have to be an evangelical Christian to accept. I've known people who have unnecessarily walked away from the Christian faith because of answers to legitimate struggles that sound dismissive and even disrespectful of the inner turmoil that generates the questions. To be sure, interviews and newspapers lack the nuance of personal exchange, and I would not want to assume that Keller's face-to-face engagement with a genuine skeptic would mirror his answers here. Still, for pastoral reasons, I would have liked to have seen more of option 3 than defaulting to options 1 and 2. He gave options at the start of the article that weren't relevant. I believe the Christian faith and those struggling with it deserve better. I also think the Christian faith is subtle and diverse enough to handle it.
I don't agree with him. Yeah, I don't. Because here's the thing. It's like he's saying, what I heard in his response was, you should have had a more political answer to it, right? When sometimes some people just want an answer to a question. Keller answered the guy's question. The guy asked a question, Keller answered it.
Yeah.
Right? Like, I mean, you got to treat everybody like they're 3. It's a grown man asking you a question. Do I got to believe this? Or blah, 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 blah. And Keller did not just say yes or no. He offered a bit of context on either side of it. But he answered the man's question. He didn't round about it or answer his question with another question. He answered it. That's a genuine way to live.
Yeah. So, like, I mean, if there's something I can agree with or at least sympathize in his response, it's like, do I recognize that the word's not coming to me. This is a barrier. This is a barrier for some folks, like things like virgin birth and miracles. Like it's here's the difference. There's a difference between it being a barrier and being a point where, like, hey, that's hard to believe. Because it should be.
Yeah, exactly.
It should be hard to believe. Like, it's like people doing, that's why they call them miracles. Otherwise, they would say Jesus did stuff everybody did.
Jesus did regular things.
Yeah, and here's the deal. Like, I was actually studying some stuff in Mark today, and there are other historical accounts around the time of people casting out demons. But, like, they're actually hard to pinpoint. Like, they're mentioned that there are guys who go around doing exorcisms, but, like, no one's as near well attested as Jesus is. And Jesus's exorcisms are awesome. Like, all these guys, these people who claim to be exorcists would go around and, like, they've got special phrases and they've got, like, tools and things and they got to hold things or say certain things. And, like, Jesus's exorcisms are just like, get out.
Get out, shut up, don't say nothing else.
Exactly. Like, when it says Jesus rebuked them, and like it's a colloquial shut up. It's be muzzled, basically. And so, like, are these things hard to believe? Sure. That's why they're miracles, right? And so do I understand that someone says, man, when you say this guy rose from the dead, yeah, I like that's hard to believe. And, like, I would agree there, but there's no reason to back away from the fact that, yes, that is what happened. Let's work through why that's a problem for you. Because, again, if the premise is that Jesus was God, because, like, he's arguing things about, is he the, did he resurrect from the dead or was he born of a virgin? But, like, if he's God, neither of those is a problem.
That's right.
Like, no, but if he's not God, if he's just a person, then frankly, the rest of the New Testament is completely fallible. And you should let it go. Like, there's reason to even try to continue to be a Christian.
It's not worth your time at all, right? Like if you can't agree to the premise that, and once again, this might be a hard line, but if you can't believe in the premise that Jesus is God, then you have no reason to listen to this man. Right? Like, that's not why most people who follow Jesus are following Jesus, because he's wise, right? There's plenty of wisdom going around. Even a man will get me, well, I'm like, that's wise.
Yeah, right.
You know, that makes great sense, you know, and I might roll on that for a couple of days and think, I really like the heart of this thing. I'm gonna beast my life off this for a while. But the truth of the matter is, I don't follow Jesus because he's wise, right? I follow Jesus because he's the Son of God, and it'd be foolish for me to take advice from anybody else.
Yeah. And so, like, I mean, that's the thing, is like behind this question, behind the, I think Pete's response to it, is a desire for inclusivity that is unnecessary. It's just not necessary. To say, like, is it to what value is it to be like, hey, everybody's a Christian? I don't like. I actually thought Keller's example of Greenpeace. I'm not. I don't belong to Greenpeace. Like, they would not take me in the organization. Like, there's basic things that, like, I don't. We don't agree or disagree. I just don't. I'm not invested, right? And so, like, to stretch a definition to say it needs to be inclusive of all these things so that people can say, yes, I'm a Christian. The question is, why do you want to be? That's what I would be interested in knowing is, like, what is compelling here if mainline evangelical Christians say, look, yes, virgin birth, yes, resurrection, yes, miracles. And you're like, no virgin birth, no resurrection, no miracles. Like, why do you want in here? What is it that's drawing you into this belief system that is founded on things that you don't actually take in? If you like his moral teaching, but like you're also having to skip some of it.
The thing is like his moral teaching is not sustainable without him. I mean, it's just not, right?
Yeah.
Like the sacrificial life that God is asking you to live, and the way that he's asking you to go about your life, I don't know how you could pursue that and keep it strong your whole lifetime without him. Like, it's exhausting and it's draining, and there's generally no benefit for you.
Yeah.
Like, on all the tick marks of what you would call successful life, Jesus does not attest to any of those things. He says, this is a successful life. Do these things. And by the way, there will be very little feedback from society on that you're doing great. You know, it will be mostly you will be sustained through my strength in the way that this goes through. And so the problem is he will bail on so-called Christianity anyway, because without the root of it being, Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit filling you up as you go and as you do the things that Christ has asked you to do, without the Holy Spirit to help you through that, I don't know how you can sustain it. I've seen it fail way more times than I've seen it succeed.
Yeah, yeah, and I think that's kind of the crux. Like, the crux of this is that, like, do I think? Let me ask you this way. Have I personally ever had doubts about some of these things?
Yes.
Yes, absolutely I have. For the same reasons that people might have doubt, but like that this guy's proposing.
It's tough to swallow, Ben.
Yeah, yeah, no, it is. Like, but that's frankly that makes it more legitimate. Like,
that makes it God sized to me.
Yeah.
Right?
So and I get it. Like, you can call me, you can say, well, okay, Christianity's foolish, they have to buy into things by faith. Yeah, that's kind of the nature of the thing. And so I get the doubt. I think it is. This guy said, look, can you accept that this type of doubt is an opportunity for spiritual growth? Yes. Actually, that's exactly what Keller said. That he answered that question. He's acting like Keller didn't say that. The question the guy asked was, do you ever have doubts? Do most people have faced struggle or at times over these kinds of questions? And like I said earlier, Keller's response was, yes and yes. In the Bible, the book of Jude tells Christians to be merciful to those who doubt. We should not encourage people to simply stifle all doubts. Doubts force us to think things out and reexamine our reasons, and that can, in the end, lead to stronger faith. Which is exactly what this character is saying that he should have done. So I feel like he's chopping short parts of the discussion. So is it okay for people to have doubts? If this guy, the guy that was doing the interview with Keller, a bit like, the asking of the question, am I a Christian? I think you're asking the wrong guy. Like, that's a Jesus distinction, I guess. But the question is it like, you know, if you want to be a Christian, why are we rejecting things that either Christ says, does, or represents? And like, if you want to reject those, why do you want to be a Christian anyway? And like, so those are things I actually don't quite understand. Why you want to try to drag kind of the inclusivity of a group to include you, even though you don't actually agree with some of the things. Now, that begs the question, in times when I have doubted, if I have times of doubt in some of these things, does that make me not a Christian? There's actually where I think Keller's response probably required some nuance, but I don't think I'm actually – him and I would be disagreeing on this point. I think just the space and the question the guy asked is how that came off.
Yeah, and that dude made a solid point, which I'm glad he conceded that the newspaper – that's a hard place to have this conversation.
Yep.
So the better question is, should Keller just bowed out and said, yeah, you know what, this is not the right place to do this.
You know, that's what's difficult. I had read this before I saw the response to it. I'd read it, and I looked through the comments, and that was a mistake. Like, I mean, they were just skewering the guy. And frankly, a lot of it was – it lacked sense, to be honest with you. Like, I get it. If you want to make some arguments against Christianity, like, at least do it with some sense. with some practicality, with some reason. Like people that claim things are unreasonable, like have no premise. The arguments they were having in the comment section, like I can make a better case as to why Christianity was false than these people.
Right.
Like pull yourselves together, all right? If you're gonna argue on reason and fact and inference and all this stuff, like do a good job, damn it. it was embarrassing. There were plenty of atheists who were seeking true things. And I think some of them will actually land at Jesus because it's true. But they're doing a much better job than represented by some of these folks. So I get that kind of thing. But, you know, as you approach this, you know, should we be having these type of discussions? I think the answer is still yes, because I think you're still representing true things and people will react to true things in different ways. And one of Keller's responses was like, I don't think faith has to be at odds with science. I don't think it is. And so, you know, we don't have to bow out like the conversation's lost. Like, if the Bible is speaking to it, I think we can speak to it. If the Bible's not making a case about it, like, say, dinosaurs in the Old Testament, okay, there's no reason to put it on the mantle and act like we've got the thing nailed.
Yeah, but that's the thing with doubt, right? And when doubt is a healthy thing to have to reevaluate if you actually believe what you say you believe, and that's okay, right? But realize it's a healthy doubt if you're answering it through God's ways first, man ways second.
Yeah.
Right? And it's almost guaranteed that they will match up, right? If you're willing to let them. You know what I'm saying? Like there's some occasions where I'm willing to accept a virgin birth just because the Bible says so. I don't care how many guys attest to it. If the God of the Bible says, here's what happened, all that seems to logically make sense to me on the way that God – it's consistent with the way that God works. If he has an earthly father, then we have a problem, right?
Right.
Like, and so his perfect atonement for sin that no one else could offer because he was sinless, like – and because he was God, he cannot have an earthly father. That makes sense to me, right? And that's actually all the more proof that I need. And so some of those things where they're like, look, it sounds too far-fetched or it sounds crazy. If you let God answer his own conundrums, I believe that he will. It has to be that way, and it had to be for the plan that he had in motion of what Christ was going to do here on earth, right? And so, like, if I'm willing to accept any part of Jesus – and the fact that he is the Son of God, that I'm willing to accept just about anything they say in the Bible about it. Because if it's God's ways and God's thoughts, then who am I to say that's not a plausible thing to do or was not the right thing to do?
Yeah. Yeah. So I think that's what it boils down to. Like, I would definitely recommend reading both. Like, if you're interested in it, the New York Times has a – actually, if you go to ChristianPost.com, there's a discussion about this out there. And it has links to kind of both the responses. I think both of the guys handled it well. Like the responses, I think the ends guy was still gracious in his response. Like he wasn't cruel. I think he disagreed in a very good way. And I think there's something to take away from. I don't think skepticism is bad because I think God can handle it. I think the Bible can handle it. I'm not worried about skepticism. But the posturing that says, look, let's soften things that we believe are true things so that someone doesn't feel that their doubt is unwarranted. Like that part is a little bit weird. Like why would I don't need to change I need to direct people to it. Like if I'm skeptic, hey, I don't believe this, then it's my liability to say, all right, let me help you with where this is coming from. If you accept that Jesus was God, then these things are back on the table and make a lot of sense. If you reject that Jesus is God, then actually that's a foundational Christian problem.
Yeah.
Like it's a foundational Christian problem, and the question is, what do you want to be a Christian for? Like, if none of those things are true, I don't know what you're trying to attain. And so there isn't any reason to change what you believe to be true things to make people feel better, but it does present a liability to say, like, if my kids don't believe something that I'm explaining to them, then I can help them and understand why it's true or why it makes sense, not to say, well, maybe it's not, and maybe that's okay. I mean— I don't know what the value to that is without otherwise rejecting to an honest skepticism. If you don't have the foundation that you say, I believe Jesus is God, then what your skepticism here makes total sense. I get it. Like it's within a completely rational framework. In fact, I get there's a lot of arguments from an atheistic perspective that I totally like. They're completely reasonable arguments. Yeah. These are wise people that are trying to discern the world around them, and they're trying to do it without a God. And so the conclusions they come to make sense. There are no supernatural things. Well, if you reject supernatural things and say that can never be the case, otherwise it would just be natural, then you'll never come to a conclusion that there's a God. I get it. Your premise makes it so that will never happen. That's not unreasonable. I just don't think it's right. And so I think we can you can do these things with grace. You can do these things with love and care for people and say, look, here's what the true thing is. Let me help you with where it's at. And then you can either accept or reject. But I don't know that it makes sense to stay. There's certain like table stakes. There's things that are the Bible is pretty clear about that I don't think you can just dismiss or soften just so people kind of feel more included, because then you're not actually pointing them to the thing.
No, and you're not doing anybody any favors by giving them gray lines, right? Like letting them redefine terms. You don't get to redefine on who Jesus says is a follower of me. And like that's where you feel like it's we're excluding people or making people feel like they don't have it all together. Well, they don't. So wouldn't they rather know that? Right? Wouldn't you rather know if you didn't understand something correctly?
Yeah.
Or what the definition is like. We like to change the definition of things so it includes more people. Where the truth of the matter is, the definition of the thing is the thing.
That's why you define things.
That's right.
Definitions provide an exclusivity. It's not an open door. Otherwise, it wouldn't define anything. It would just be kind of this open chasm of things that could be anything. But like we got dictionaries using precision in our words so that we know exactly what people are talking about. And then we attack the word and say, look, but it doesn't talk about what I want it to talk about, so I want it to be something different.
Yeah, so, I mean, imagine trying to do algebra where X equals Y plus whatever you want it to be.
Yeah.
I mean, it's impossible to deal with, you know?
And the question, and again, like, there's someone had to have addressed this. Maybe I'll see if I can go find it, because I'm interested, again, wise people who don't believe what I believe, I'd be interested in, like, what do you care? What do you care to be a Christian then? If you don't believe some of the basic tenets, like what does it matter to be a Christian? There's even like alternative faith communities. I just don't understand the pursuit of Christianity if you don't believe in Christ.
That's right. A Unitarian church would totally let you get along with this.
Yeah. Yeah. No, there you go. They dig on it. So I'm kind of interested in that pursuit there. But anyway, go check it out. I think skepticism is fine. I would just say like there's no reason to reduce truth in the pursuit of trying to flesh it out. Flesh it out with true things. And that makes a lot of sense. But go check that out. And if you guys have any thoughts, shoot us an email, infolifeinthepath.org, or harass us on Twitter or something. So whatever makes you feel good, you can do that. Mike, we got time for like one Dear Life from the Path.
All right, here we go. Dear Life from the Path. Over the years, we have helped out our daughters as much as we could. One daughter, quotes, Doreen, has needed more help than the others. She has four children who are near and dear to our hearts. They have been living with us the better part of their lives. Doreen married a guy who was the father of three of the children. I'll call him John. He's in trouble with the law constantly and can't hold a job. After he moved them all in with us, John decided he wanted to move back home to his family, so he packed up everyone and left. We told Doreen we could no longer support them financially and that if they wanted to move away, they would assume that responsibility. Now she's writing us saying that they can't pay the rent and their electricity is being shut off. She wants us to loan them money. We refused. Now we can no longer talk to, text, write, Skype, or communicate in any way with our grandchildren. The sister-in-law says we lost that privilege. My wife is distraught. Can we fix this? Will our daughter come around?
The sister-in-law?
I don't know.
What's that? Who's that?
She must have stuck her nose somewhere.
Where did she get here?
I can't believe they took a phone call from her.
Yeah, I mean, that's not advice, really. I mean, I think you handled it. Obviously, there's a destructive thing there. You would have lost the money. And who knows whether they're telling the truth. I mean, unless you wanted to go over there and check it out, you could. But, like, that's not someone who's saying – that's not a healthy request for money, right? That's not something that says, hey, we could use some help. They're saying they're holding your grandkids for ransom. Yeah. They're saying you give us money, otherwise you can't speak to your grandkids. That's kidnapping. They're just not your kids.
Yeah. I mean, this is a tough situation because, like, there are, you know, there's some Bible verses that start ringing in your head that say, you know, just hand over the money, even if they're going to do bad things with it, or even if you're going to lose it, just hand over the cash.
Yeah, but
I'm just saying that's what would sniff around this topic. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, I think you do your best you can here. And I think there's enough here to say, you help people. And you just know that there's a risk to helping people, but like you don't even know that there's even a factual part of this conversation, and it's giving money into an unhealthy environment. So like, here's the thing: there's actually other means that aren't you to solving some of these problems, right? Like, there's food banks. There's you know, if nobody's working, why nobody can work and keep the power on? Didn't they move in with his parents?
Yeah, that's what it sounded like. There was a plan, and then, I don't know, must have fell apart.
That's unclear, too. Like, his parents can't help? I'm just saying, like, there's enough here that this is a fishy situation that, like, I would know enough, or there's enough here for me to say, I don't think I'm giving to something that is actually beneficial.
I mean, would you be all right with, say, look, yeah, I'll pay the power bill, but I'll call the power company and pay it. You know what I'm saying? Like, these are the needs that you're putting forth. I'll bring groceries down, and then I'll pay the power bill.
Yeah.
Like, I will go down there and pay it.
Yeah.
But, I'm not going to loan you money, but I'll take care of these problems that you got.
I might do that once.
Yeah.
I might do that once. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a rough situation. Let's see what Secular has to say, and then we'll see if we're in agreement here. Secular says, you cannot fix what's wrong with your daughter and her husband by giving them money, so you were right to refuse. They moved out with the understanding that your financial help would stop. That's true. You set that forward. Your daughter is now trying to coerce you into giving them money through emotional blackmail. For your own sakes, I hope you will not give in to it, because if you do, there will be no end to it. As to whether your daughter will come around, it will happen as soon as she needs you, because her husband has bailed on her. So, to be honest with you, I struggle a little bit here, because as far as I'm concerned, there are two people sinning here, and it is affecting four children. And where I am more likely to go, you know what, I'll pay the power bill, I'll bring the groceries.
Yeah.
And I think that even though it's very obvious I'm being taken advantage of, I don't know that you can combat that, A, with I told you so's.
No.
Just being right in the fact that they're wrong. And B, like, these kids ain't got no choice in this thing.
Yeah, I mean, the question is really is are the things true? Which if you went down there to check on it and said, look, I'll bring some groceries by and see whether, and if they accept, then great. And I'll pay your power bill, and if they accept, then great.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, and like it's going to take a little effort on your part, and you're probably going to get burned, and I've had a lot of success. I was talking to somebody about this here recently, and like, look, you're just the information man. Like, I'll be down, I'll pay your power bill, and I'll get you some groceries, and you don't have to feel emotionally either way about that, right? Like, if they don't want to accept it, or they're like, we'd prefer the loan, then you're like, yeah, sorry, that's just not what I'm offering.
Right.
I'm offering to pay the power bill and get some groceries.
Yeah.
And so, like, and that's what you're offering. And if they're willing to take that, then that's actually what they needed, and they'll take it. If they wanted it for other things, or they're just flat out irresponsible with their money, they'll say no, and you say, well, you know, that's just not what I can offer right now. And then be okay with that.
No, yeah, that's true. Like, there's probably a way to approach it to offer help in which you're...
You can be assured that your stuff's going to where it needs to go.
Yeah, right. You bring food to the door and they let you come in, then you know they needed food, then great. You know they got food, you got to help out, right? But if they refuse and say, look, we just want the loan, you can't come here and bring food, then yeah, that's probably a good indicator that you should stay out of that.
Right on.
Yeah, okay. So that's what I do. I like that. All right, hey, you've been listening live from The Path. Thanks for hanging out with us at the beginning of 2017. We hope you enjoyed the show. We will see you next week, and if I knew what we were going to talk about, I'd tell you. But maybe I'll throw something out on the Facebook later on this week when I know what's going on, and you can ponder on that. Like I said, if you've got any thoughts about the show, shoot us an email, info@lifefromthepath.org. Please do give us a rating on iTunes. It helps. And we will see you next week. In the meantime, be faithful, Ians. Ah, shoot. I messed it up at the start of 2017.
Terrible.
Be faithful in the means. God will handle the ends. You've been listening to Live from the Path.